Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com. Welcome to What's in Your Way is the Way with your host, Mary O'Malley, inviting you to open to the radical notion that in your life, whatever you perceive to be in your way is the way. In other words, your challenges, whether they be relationships, compulsions, finances, or illness, come with gifts embedded in them that can bring healing and allow you to experience the joy of being fully alive. Mary is a counselor, awakening mentor, inspirational speaker, and the author of What's in the Way is the Way, The Gift of Our Compulsions, Belonging to Life, and The Magical Forest of Aliveness. What's in Your Way is the Way with Mary O'Malley is part of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Welcome to What's in Your Way is the Way, and I am your host, Mary O'Malley. And today we are exploring the fertility of the dark, part one. Fear of our pain. Enlightenment consists not only in seeing the luminous, but in making darkness visible. The latter is much more difficult, so it is far less popular. Carl Jung. In this moment where you are listening, dewdrops are reflecting the morning light. A rainbow of colors is appearing out of the heart of flowers. Whales are singing their ancient tunes. Babies, who were just one seed 9 months ago, are taking their first breath, and wind is caressing ancient bristlecone pines high in the alpine forests. All around us is a magical realm, earth, air, sun, and water being woven over and over again into myriad amazingly beautiful forms. Now, notice where your awareness has been primarily for the last 24 hours. Have you been present for this wondrous unfolding? Probably not. If you are like most people, your attention is usually focused on your own individual struggles, big ones, little ones, scary ones, and fun ones. If we watch what we're doing all day long, we can begin to see that we are actually working at life. We are oriented towards struggle, lost in the land of always trying to make ourselves and our lives different than what they are. An image I often use is that we are like little children completely focused on trying to unravel a ball of yarn, and all the while we are sitting in paradise. We are so busy with our struggles that we are not here for life. Beyond this narrow focus is a reality, a safe, benevolent, trustable, magical, and fascinating reality that is always with us, no matter where we are, no matter what is happening. But we don't notice. One of the primary reasons we don't notice is that we fear all levels of pain, physical, emotional, and mental. In this fear, we have become addicted to the endless struggle of trying to get rid of what we don't like in our lives and go toward what we do. We can see this in our commercials Oh, if you ate too much, just drink this antacid, and you'll be able to ignore the message of discomfort and overeat again. It is evident in our religions. Salvation is going to the light and leaving the dark behind. Also, in our whole response to the aging process, the dramatic increase in plastic surgery, the billions of dollars spent on potions and lotions. And finally, in our denial of death, the warehousing of the elderly, and the sanitation of the dying process. We want one side of life, the pleasant, without the other, the unpleasant, and wonder why we are lost in struggle most of the time. Don't respond to the pain in your life, says our mind. Go towards the pleasant and the desirable and leave the rest behind. If that doesn't work, we deny, blame, and manipulate. Absolutely certain that if life is difficult, then something is wrong. This is broadcast from pulpits, the Congress, our therapists, and especially ourselves. In the belief that there is such thing as a perfect and together human being, we have maimed, brutalized, and tried to exorcise the weak and imperfect parts of ourselves. We struggle with what we don't like about our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our relationships, our communities, and our world. We are conquerors, addicted to the belief that if we could just manage life by ignoring, denying, fixing, or getting rid of what we don't like, then and only then will we know lasting peace. This approach denies that pain is a thread in the tapestry of life and has an essential role in the scheme of things. It is as if we decided that the tide coming in is good and the tide going out is bad, completely ignoring the fact that it wouldn't work if the tide always came in. The land would flood, crops would die, and we'd have wet feet all the time. We fail to see that when the tide goes out, it then gathers up wonderful gifts from the sea, beautiful shells, water-carved logs, rich communities of seaweed, and on its return deposits them on the shore. If the tide of our physical, emotional, and spiritual lives always came in, we would be stagnant creatures. Every single time our tide goes out, we are renewed and enriched by all the gifts it brings as it flows back in. Because of our refusal to see the essential nature of darkness and all the gifts it brings, we are caught off guard when the tide has gone out in our lives as it is destined to do. We then look desperately for someone or something to blame, oftentimes ourselves. Don't trust the ebb and flow of life. Don't listen to pain and what it's feeding back to you. Just get rid of it, is the credo that we live by. We need to learn how to work with our pain in new ways, understanding that it is an integral part of life. We need to learn how to include it rather than exclude it. To awaken our hearts so that we can heal, we need to recognize that each of us is destined to take on challenges in our lives, get lost in them, and then finally bring them to the light of compassionate awareness. As John Lee said in Writing from the Body, letting the shadow speak its peace is a part of the process that leads us to the good stuff. If we can't let ourselves go deeply into the shadow, we may never reach the places in ourselves where tenderness resides. Freedom comes when we learn how to respond rather than react to the difficult in our lives, whether it's a deeply challenged body, a broken heart, an abusive boss, deep rage, freezing cold, an overdue deadline, or a dying friend. We can learn the power of relating to the difficult parts of our lives rather than being caught in their web. Pain then becomes an awakener, an ally, and even a friend. As Stephen Levine has said, pain sucks, but it grabs our attention. That which is difficult in our lives is here to heal us, and our job is to learn how to pay attention. Let us begin by getting to know how our resistance to the uncomfortable keeps us caught in struggle. The victor-victim cycle. Your hand opens and closes and opens and closes. If it were always a fist or always stretched open, you would be paralyzed. Your deepest presence is in every small contracting and expanding, the two as beautifully balanced and coordinated as bird wings. Rumi. Our addiction to struggling with our pain moves back and forth between two extremes, the victor powering over and the victim overpowered. We all swing back and forth on this pendulum, experiencing joy when we feel we have it all together, and despair when we think our pain will never end. The victor says that a successful life is one in which our relationships are always well-oiled and running smoothly, so we never have a compulsive urge, and we are in control financially, emotionally, physically, and mentally. It is the fixing, changing, manipulating part of us that is irritated in rush hour traffic, believes that our lives would be better if only our mate would change, is hateful of those sagging lines on our face, and is absolutely certain that depression is an indication that something is wrong with us. Its core belief is that difficulty and darkness are signs that we are not doing it right. This part inside of each of us says that if we just think positively, be proactive, take vitamins and exercise, we will not only be able to deal with everything that comes our way, but we will also be able to be in control of whatever comes. The victor completely ignores the fact that there are forces far greater than itself that influence life. It's like each one of us is a tiny inlet on the Oregon coast, saying that we can control the entire Pacific Ocean. When something goes wrong with our efforts to get everything in order, the only conclusion we can come to is that we have done something wrong or haven't tried hard enough. When trying to control doesn't bring us the results we yearn for, we slip into the victim mode, the part of us that feels overpowered by life. We so desperately want to feel sorry for ourselves when we are greatly challenged. We are also certain somewhere deep inside of us that challenges are here because we have done something wrong. The victim's litany is, "Oh, I can't do this. I've always failed before. It's too much. This is not fair. Why am I being punished? What did I do to deserve this? I'll never get through this." The victim mode looks out upon the world and says they can do it, but I can't. It is oftentimes accompanied by blame. If we can't find someone to pin it on, "Oh, I had bad parents," then we turn it against ourselves, spinning down into a maze of self-hate and despair. On the surface, it looks like a position of powerlessness, but the victim holds great power. It keeps us from dealing with what is uncomfortable. "Oh, it's just too much." And it demands that others react to the definition of us as fragile, never confronting us, always being kind. The victim is scrambling for control as much as the victor is. The victor is me against it all, against my life, my emotions, my body, my mind. The victim is all of this is against me. The victor comes from the belief that I have to do it all, and the victim's wail is I can't. Both are reactors to the experience of living, rather than responders. Both are based on fear, the fear that we are separate and disconnected from the whole, and that the entire responsibility for the unfolding of our lives is ours alone. This addiction to struggle runs so deep that we never step back and examine whether it works or not. If we look carefully, it becomes evident that this approach to our lives only brings us a moment of respite from the struggle of trying to manage our pain. We seem to get our lives together, only to have them dissolve into chaos again. We hide in the deeper realms of our consciousness the parts of our personality that we most hate and fear, only to have them subtly run our lives. We have learned to manipulate the appearance of things while sitting upon an ocean of pain, and we wonder why we are anxious behind the walls of our managing. It is important to understand that we are talking about becoming aware of, not annihilating, the victor-victim mode, for it has a role to play in the maturing human. Going back and forth between the two extremes is a part of awakening. Rather than judging and trying to stop the endlessly swinging pendulum, it is far more helpful to begin to notice how we are functioning. In that awareness, the possibility of something new is born. From this noticing, it begins to dawn upon us that not only have we never been able to nail down perfection, but it is exactly this addiction to having it all together, this belief that the good life is the one that is comfortable all the time, that keeps us caught in struggle. Jim Henson's movie The Dark Crystal beautifully illustrates the integral relationship of dark and light. The movie revolves around a powerful crystal that is the centerpiece of a mythical land. When a shard of the crystal is lost, it becomes dark, and the land is divided between good and evil, with the evil forces occupying the castle where the crystal resides, using its power to try to control the land. The forces of light are not the usual saviors committed to destroying any trace of the dark side. They know the light, but they are stuck in concepts and rituals that disempower them. When the shard of the crystal is found, the mystics begin a journey back to the castle. As they enter the room where the crystal is, they see the dark beings in a circle around the crystal. Instead of fighting with them, the mystics circle around the crystal too, and at the moment the shard is put back into place, the mystics merge with the dark beings. The crystal then becomes radiant, the darkness is transformed, and the land is restored. Jim Henson clearly understood the interdependent nature of the dark and the light in our world. Until we wake up to our addiction to running away from our pain, we will never truly be free. Peace comes from learning how to ride the pendulum of joy and sorrow, loss and gain, loving and hating, fearing and trusting. So let us explore how we can respond to the challenges of life in a way that ennobles and energizes rather than depletes and degrades. There are five basic skills that will shift your relationship to your challenges. First, the ability to trust that pain is an essential part of your life. Second, the art of including rather than resisting and fearing. Third, the skill of becoming curious, responding rather than reacting. Four, naming the parts of ourselves that upset and disturb us. And five, creating a relationship with your pain. All of these skills allow our struggling mind to be touched by the vast healing of our hearts so that we can truly know the peace we long for. Let us now begin to explore the art of trusting pain. No other way. Could we but see the pattern of our days, we should discern how devious were the ways by which we came to this, the present time, this place in life, and we should see the climb our soul has made up through the years, and we should forget the hurts, the wanderings, the fears, the wastelands of our life, and know that we could come no other way or grow into our good without these steps our feet found hard to take, our faith found hard to meet. The road of life winds on, and we, as travelers, go from turn to turn until we come to know the truth that life is endless and that we forever are inhabitants of all eternity. Martha Smock. What if pain was not a mistake? What if pain didn't mean we screwed up, they screwed up, or God fell asleep on the job? What if each of us received our own measure of pain when we took on a body, not for punishment, but because it would be our teacher of awareness and compassion? What if there was another way to work with pain, a way that allowed us to open up into a place that was bigger than struggle itself? And what if one of the greatest gifts we could give the world would be to move beyond struggling with our pain into being able to meet it with great compassion? To open up to this possibility, we have to first explore the very novel idea that pain is not a mistake. Agnes Whistling Elk, a Native American shaman from Manitoba, spoke this truth in a most eloquent way. If you look at something carefully, you will always be able to see its dark side, and yet we choose never to look into the shadows. Understand that it is what you choose not to observe in your life that controls your life. Everything begins with a circle of motion. Without the positive and negative poles, there would be no movement, no creation. Without the dark side, your beauty would not exist. Don't be afraid to look at both sides. You need them both. Honor all as part of the Great Spirit. Everywhere we look, we can see the truth of Agnes's words. Without positive and negative poles, there would be no movement, no creation. This shows up in the atom, which is a combination of positive and negative charges. It is evident in the acid-alkaline balance in our bodies and in the fact that the opposites of male and female are necessary in the procreation of complex life forms. It is also noticeable in the violence of nature. Mountain ranges are born when two tectonic plates collide. New forests are brought forth after lightning fires. The importance of the negative aspect of life also shows up inside of us. We need our pain, our imperfections, and our failures. We would not be who we are without them. The author Thomas More invites us into this spacious relationship with that which disturbs us when he says, "This requirement that we have to be perfect, that we have to get ourselves emotionally right, is such a burden. The more we try, the worse it gets. And so we try one type of therapy after another. It's pretty defeating. See, soul really thrives in failure and imperfection." Jung said that soul moves at the weak point, where the personality is thin, where things are not secure and stable. That's where soul has an entry. We need those vulnerable points. On every level, in every experience, and in each being's existence, the dance of life is a dance of dark and light. Darkness is rich and necessary, the place of fertility and creativity. half of the earth is always bathed in the dark of night. And out of black, moist soil comes astounding creativity. Seeds, including us, incubated away from the light, and plants do their growth work in the dead of night. The same is true for our emotional and spiritual lives. Each of us was given a pair of opposites, a desire to awaken and great resistance, vast courage and deep fear, raw hatred and an awakening heart. The opposites are our teachers. In a way, the dance of our lives is about cooking the opposites until they blend into the rich soup of our potential. Brian Swim, in his series Canticle of the Cosmos, reveals the necessity of the challenges of our lives through the example of a hawk that just wants all obstacles to catching its prey removed. When it demands that the mouse slows down so it is easier to catch, the hawk's speed is no longer necessary and begins to diminish. With further reduction of the mouse's ability to run and hide, the hawk would then not need to fly anymore, for it could simply walk after the slow-moving mouse, and so its majestic wing feathers would drop away. Wishing the mouse to become immobile, the hawk's keen eyesight would not be required, for it could stumble around and bump into its meal. Asking to receive its desires with no obstacles in the way, the hawk's unique beauty would vanish as its razor-sharp eyesight, its soaring flight, and its awesome accuracy dissipated. He goes on to say that embedded deep in the hawk's heart is the desire for its enemy to flourish, for it knows that engagement with the obstacles in its life is the birth of itself. Brian concludes, "It is only in this engaged life, this marriage with our enemies, that we can discover who we are, what our creativity is, and what our destinies are. To trust the benevolence of life, especially around the challenges of our lives, is to transform our relationship to life from one of struggle to one of creative response. Rather than being caught in the victor-victim cycle, we can enter the moment no matter what is appearing, with a sense of adventure, a keen curiosity, and a compassionate heart." The actor Christopher Reeve, in his first interview after falling from his horse and becoming paralyzed, said, "Either the universe is totally random and is just molecules colliding all the time in total chaos, and your job is to make sense of the chaos, or you could say sometimes things happen for a reason, and your job is to discover the reason. But either way, I see meaning and opportunity, and that has made all the difference." The healing we yearn for comes from a shift of perspective about the role that challenges have in our lives. Christopher spoke about the terror and despair he felt when he first grasped the enormity of what had happened. He had moments of wanting to die. Meeting something he had no power to stop or change offered the possibility of either ensnaring him in a web of rage and self-pity or transforming his life. When his son came running into the room yelling, "Daddy, Daddy," he realized in that moment that he was much more than his crippled body and that he was needed. From this perspective, he began to discover the meaning and the opportunity of what was happening to him. And for the rest of his life, he lived from a deeper purpose than before the accident. He became a spokesperson for spinal cord injuries and truly made a difference in many people's lives. But he did so much more. He invited a whole society to acknowledge that the challenges in our lives can ennoble, heal, and inspire us. There's another wonderful example of this in Stories of the Spirit and Stories of the Heart by Jack Kornfield. A physician speaks about a 24-year-old man who had lost his entire leg to bone cancer At first, he was very angry and bitter, caught in a strong sense of injustice and a very deep hatred for all well people. After working with him for a while, the doctor noticed a profound shift. The young man began coming out of his victim mode. He started to visit other people who had suffered severe physical losses also. He became present for them in their grief process just as the doctor had been for him, and offered a living example of the healing power of accepting what is. A year later, this man met with a doctor to review their work together. They came across a picture that he had drawn right after losing his leg. It was of a vase, and running through it was a deep, black crack. This was the image he had of his body right after he lost his leg. He had perceived himself as a completely broken human being. In response to the picture, he said, "Oh, this one isn't finished." He picked up a yellow crayon, and putting his finger on the crack, he said, "You see here where it is broken? That is where the light comes through." And with the yellow crayon, he drew light streaming through the crack in the vase, through the crack in his life. To get a sense of how profound it would be to begin to trust pain rather than always resisting it, let us go on a journey together. Close your eyes and allow a few deep breaths. Then begin to notice this living moment of your life. Here is the river of breath moving through you, the river that moves through all of life, rising and falling, rising and falling. Feel the pressure of your body's connection to the support that you are sitting on, and allow yourself to relax into that support. Recognize the warmth or the coolness of the space you are in. Be here with your life as it is right now. Now, in your mind's eye, see the earth in all of its beauty floating in the vast ocean of space, the blues and browns, and the swirling white clouds. From this spacious view, imagine all of the suffering that humans have experienced on our planet. Terrorist attacks, starving children in Africa, men and women who have died agonizing deaths alone on a battlefield, people dying of painful diseases in all parts of the world. Feel what happens in your body as you resist this. Watch it tighten. Watch your mind close down and your heart ache. Now, shift your perception and accept for a moment the essential nature of darkness in this land of duality. Trust that it is here not to curse the world or because we are miserable sinners. It is just a part of life. We live in a world where everything is constantly changing and everything eventually dies. This is neither good nor bad. It just is what is. No, the darker aspects of life come from the same creativity that molded mountains and birthed stars. Notice what happens in your body as you let go of railing against these dark forces and begin to honor the fertility of the dark. Now, go back to hating and fearing these forces and see what happens in your body. Feel the outrage and the unwillingness to let go of struggling with it all. Then, feel how this energy ricochets around your body, upsetting your inner balance and equilibrium. Now, go back again to the perception of an awakening world and trusting the fertility of the dark. And see what happens inside of you. When you're ready, bring your attention back to awareness of the physical world around you, and then open your eyes. Your life like the universe, is made up of great darkness, brilliant light, and everything in between. For a moment, just sit in the center of it all. To see life in this way is not to condone hurtful acts. There have been many unspeakably cruel things that people have done to other people and to the planet itself. The point is that we've tried warring with them, and it doesn't work. We're seeing that fighting people or religions or countries will never solve these problems. We'll just find ourselves caught in the same mind that created them all in the first place, the mind that perceives light as good and dark as bad. Healing comes in a shift of perception and takes the radical and courageous step of trusting darkness. It is in this trust that we can respond to it, both our own and everybody else's, from a clearer, kinder, and more skillful place. Each one of us will have deeply challenging experiences in our lives. By changing our definition of what pain is about, and thus our relationship to pain, we can learn how to use these experiences to empower and heal our lives rather than devastate and destroy. Both Christopher Reeve and the young man who lost a leg were catapulted out of a narrow definition of who they were and what they can give to life. These challenges eventually brought much more into their lives than they took away. These two men literally became more alive because of their challenges. The question we are living in is, how can we change our relationship to pain in our daily lives, both the deep ones and the more ordinary ones? How can we make this shift without having to wait for the big guns of heartache, disease, and death? We've already taken the first step by exploring the essential and ultimately benevolent nature of the challenges in our lives. The next step is to actually make room for what we most hate and fear, including our pain. Pain stayed so long, I said to him today, I will not have you with me anymore. I stomped my foot and said, be on your way, and paused there, startled at the look he wore. I, who have been your friend, he said to me, I, who have been your teacher, of all you know of understanding, love, sympathy and patience, I have taught you. Shall I go? He spoke the truth, this strange, unwelcome guest. I watched him leave and knew that he was wise. He left a heart grown tender in my breast. He left a far clearer vision in my eyes. I dried my tears and lifted up a song, even for one who had tortured me for so long. Author unknown. None of us have the power to keep pain from our lives. Each of us will continue to be taught by challenges until our last breath. From a limited perspective, walling ourselves off from pain looks like a good idea. We resist, deny, and then fight it with all of our might when it breaches our barricades. But a wall is a wall. It may serve to keep our darkness at bay for short periods of time, but it also walls us off from life. The depth to which we refuse to be aware of our pain is the depth to which we are separate from life. The radical notion of not fighting our pain is the doorway to freedom. There's a wonderful story told by Jack Kornfield in his book, Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, about Terry Dobson, a man who was studying Aikido in Japan. Having put in 8 hours of training nearly every day for 3 years, he thought he was tough. He especially liked to throw and grapple, but his martial arts skills were untested in combat. Aikido, his teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. Even though Terry understood this intellectually, in his heart he wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity where he might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. One day he found himself on a train lumbering through the suburbs of Tokyo. The car he was in was relatively empty and quiet, when all of a sudden, as the doors opened at the next station, the quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent and incomprehensible curses. He staggered into the car, drunk and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. Then Terry goes on to describe what happened next. I stood up and said to myself, "This is it. People are in danger, and if I don't do something fast, they'll probably get hurt." Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his rage. "Aha," he roared, "a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners." I looked at him with disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted to make him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A split second before he could move, someone shouted, "Hey!" It was startling. I remembered the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something, and he suddenly stumbled upon it. "Hey!" I wheeled to my left, and the drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightfully at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. "Come here, talk with me." He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared, "Why in the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow so much as moved a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. The drunk barked back, "I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business." "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said. "Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76 now, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. We worry about whether it will recover from those ice storms we had last winter." He looked up at the laborer, eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons, too," and his voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the laborer, "my wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheek. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. The train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically, "My, my, that is a difficult predicament. Sit down and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido in combat, and the essence of it was love. The old man was neither the victor nor the victim. He didn't react to the labor, he responded. Without judgment and with great compassion, he accepted him just as he was. In the same exact way, our suffering needs us. The more we fight it, the louder it gets. As Terry's teacher so eloquently said, he who fights breaks his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. The same is true with our internal community. The more we try to power over the forces that scare us and enrage us, we become caught in the endless victor and victim struggle. The way through is to welcome them. Welcoming is the art of including, allowing, and making space for our pain. And it comes automatically when we begin to move out of the collective delusion that darkness is our enemy into a deep respect for it. To recognize that whatever causes havoc and heartache in our lives is a doorway into our healing is to re-engage with life. The core challenges of our lives are the demons of renewal, and we can only gather the tremendous energy they hold for us by coming into direct relationship with them. My body has been a great teacher for learning the powerful healing of inclusion. I was born with a very sensitive body, and the older I became, the more strongly it reacted to the slightest imbalance. Most of my life, I tried to manage, bargain, and plead with life from a surcease from this discomfort. For varying periods of life, this would make a difference, but then the symptoms would come back with a vengeance. For a time, I swung on the pendulum of victor and victim. I would go to doctors and read books on healing techniques. My mind would be in full gear trying to figure out how to get rid of these unpleasant sensations in my life. I would do affirmations and bargain with God. When this didn't bring about the healing I wanted, I would fall into the victim mode. Dabbling in the land of despair, I was caught in struggle. I moved back and forth from victor to victim, holding on for dear life, absolutely certain if I could nail this pendulum to the wall, then everything would be okay. Rarely in that whole process did I stop and listen to my pain. A voice inside me said that I must not feel the depth of what was going on, for it would engulf me in an endless black hole. It was like sliding down a slippery slope, trying to hold on to every branch and rock I could get my hands on. I was lucky enough to be unable to find any handholds, to be wrenched out of my ability to manage the process anymore. When the depth of the discomfort in my body, along with the terror, rage, and despair, got deep enough, I was forced to begin to relate directly to what was happening. A statement from Stephen Levine helped me immensely when I was learning how to relate to pain rather than being lost in it. Discomfort is a drill probing through our armoring and denial, reaching the deep reservoirs of long-held isolations and fears. The tip of the drill is honed by helplessness and hopelessness, the inability to control the uncontrollable. Trusting and including rather than eradicating all that we deem wrong changes our lives. The tremendous amount of energy we use to war with what is freed up for curiosity and compassion and clarity. Welcoming is conflict resolution at its best, whether it's done over a negotiation table in Palestine or inside of us. War creates more war. Communication fosters healing, a healing that cannot happen until darkness is allowed a seat and a voice at the table of our being. When I first heard this, I felt such peace. But then I easily lost this perspective again. To the rational, logical mind, this sounds like insanity, but to the heart, it makes absolute sense. For myself, at the beginning of my awakening, there were just moments of being with my life in a compassionately curious way, like the flicker of a match in a dark cavern. But each of these flickers of honoring my darkness was a healing balm for my tortured heart. When the match flickers began to become beams of light, I was able to explore the immense cavern where all the unacceptable parts of me lived. Coming across the baths of terror and the drop-offs of self-hatred, I would again cower in this cavern and cover my head, blocking out the flickers of light. but it was beginning to seep into my awareness that darkness wasn't here because I was inherently bad, lazy, stupid, or stubborn. It was here to lead me to my wholeness. Eventually, curiosity would get the better of me, and off exploring I would go. There are two main reasons why we've been reluctant to include pain as a crucial part of ourselves. The first is the belief that going towards it means more darkness. The exact opposite is true. Imagine riding down a road on your bicycle, heading into the setting sun. The details of the landscape around you would be hazy and blurred by the strength of the light. Now, imagine turning your bike around and heading into the coming darkness. In a flash, everything would be defined and clear. The same is true for going toward our own darkness. Fear may say otherwise, but it is not true. Meeting our darkness creates more light. The second reason we resist the dark is that when we go towards that which we have formerly deemed as broken, inappropriate, or bad, it is so easy to get lost in judgment about ourselves. Coming across the parts of our shadow that we have hidden from our whole lives, it is easy to forget that everyone has both dark and light inside of them. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross once joked about writing a book called I'm Not Okay, You're Not Okay, and That's Okay. Our perfection is in our imperfection, and each of us carries a part of the human shadow. In this show, we explored the skills of trusting pain and including it rather than resisting it. In the next show, we will explore the other three skills: curiosity, noticing, and creating a relationship with our pain. In the meantime, start with little pains. Your stubbed toe, a hurt hangnail, a slight headache. And when you can, turn your attention toward it, even for just a few moments, and describe what you find there. This will lay the foundation of exploring the other three skills. Until then, may your heart be your guide. Namaste.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of DreamVision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.
Thank you for listening to this edition of What's in Your Way is the Way with your host, Mary O'Malley. You can access Mary's offerings on her websites, MaryO'Malley.com and WhatsInTheWayIsTheWay.com. Join Mary next time to experience the peace and joy that is always with you on Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.